Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iranian president says the West's accusations against Tehran's peaceful nuclear program show they seek to achieve political goals through the JCPOA revival talks. Iran censures the US for the impasse in the talks to revive the JCPOA, saying it wants objective guarantees that Washington will not torpedo the deal again. Also ahead, Ecuador's government and indigenous groups sign an agreement to end days-long protests over living costs and fuel prices that had paralyzed the country. World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's president says the Western accusations against his country's peaceful nuclear program are aimed at achieving political goals through the JCPOA negotiations. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. Raisi said the UN nuclear agency has confirmed in its multiple reports that Iran's nuclear program is transparent and has never deviated from its legal course. Iran's president also described unilateral sanctions on the country over its nuclear program as illegal and oppressive. Raisi said achieving a lasting agreement on the JCPOA hinges on the removal of sanctions and putting an unconditional end to baseless claims. He said Iran is determined to defend its right and wants all sanctions removed. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has once again blamed Washington for the current impasse in negotiations on the revival of the 2015 deal. In a statement to the UN Security Council meeting, Majid Takht-ar Avanchi also censured European signatories to the JCPOA for failing to fulfill their obligations and promises. He said Iran was denied its rights promised in the accord due to the Europeans' failure. Takht-ar Avanchi said Iran began the revival talks in Vienna with good faith and maximum flexibility, but Washington's unrealistic and rigid approach led to the current stalemate. He also criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for its counterproductive approach by issuing a U.S. proposed resolution against Iran. Takht-ar Avanchi said Iran is still ready to engage constructively for a good deal, but he said Tehran is after verifiable and objective guarantees from the U.S. that the deal will not be torpedoed again. Takht-ar Avanchi also said the EU facilitated indirect talks between Tehran and Washington in Doha earlier this week were serious and positive. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the United States' unrealistic demands have been the main obstacles to reviving the 2015 deal.
The United States will not make any changes. The United States is, as it has been from the start of the talks to rejuvenate the JCPOA, has been unrealistic in its demands. The United States violated the agreement, therefore it must unilaterally re-enter the agreement. There is no reason for any discussions. Iran does not have to make any further concessions. The United States violated the agreement, which was a violation of international law, and the United States needs to come back into it. That President Joe Biden is not willing to do so indicates that the U.S. is not serious about the agreement and has no real interest in maintaining it. It will only do so if needs, which has not happened since Trump pulled out in 2018, is not going to happen. So the United States is causing this stalemate, and it is the United States that can release it and start constructive talks by being realistic once again.
Tehran says a joint anti-Iran statement by the leaders of Bahrain and Egypt was, quote, biased and unconstructive. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said certain motives and agendas were the driving force behind allegations against Iran. Nasser Kanani urged the two Arab states to get a better understanding of regional equations and Iran's stabilizing role in West Asia. He cautioned against taking the, quote, wrong and unwise path of spreading Iranophobia. The Iranian official said such an approach serves Israel's interests. Kanani also said Iran's defense and missile capabilities pose no threat to its neighbors. He said Iran is determined to boost friendly ties with its neighbors, including Arabs. On Wednesday, Egypt's president and Bahrain's king issued a statement following a meeting in Manama. The statement accused Iran of destabilizing activities in the region. Iran's foreign minister reiterates Tehran's opposition to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic is ready to contribute to diplomatic solution to the crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahia made the remarks in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Dmytro Kuleba. He said Tehran is ready to be part of an agreement in a Black Sea corridor that would see the release of much-needed Ukrainian grain to world markets. Amir Abdullahia also invited Kuleba to pay a visit to Iran. For his part, the Ukrainian foreign minister hailed Tehran's position regarding the war in his country. He said Kiev welcomes any political support that would help bring an end to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Iran has marked the National Day of Fight Against Chemical and Biological Weapons. The occasion is to commemorate the victims of the Sardasht chemical attacks launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in June 1987. Salman Kajouri has more.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies. When Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belonged to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Kajouri, Tehran.
In Ecuador, the government and indigenous groups have signed an agreement on ending protests over President Guillermo Lasso's economic policies. The agreement includes the cessation of the protests and the gradual return of demonstrators to their city. It also provides for a 5% per gallon reduction in the price of diesel and gasoline on top of a 10% cut already conceded by the government. Talks between the two sides resumed after a short pause on Thursday to end the protests that had paralyzed the country since June 13. For nearly 3 weeks, indigenous demonstrators protested against high living costs and fuel prices. Several people died after some rallies turned violent. Road blockades by protesters led to shortages of food and medical supplies. The country's oil production has also plummeted by more than a half. Tunisia has published the draft of a new constitution that gives more explicit powers to the president. The draft is set to go to a referendum on July the 25th. It provides for a presidential system in a split from the mixed presidential parliamentary system under the country's 2014 constitution. The president would be the head of the armed forces. The document will also water down the role of parliament. The president could serve two terms of 5 years each and has the right to dissolve parliament. The draft has been written by legal experts close to President Kais Saied, who last July sacked the government and froze parliament. His actions have been described by his critics as a power grab. Some Tunisians have, however, welcomed his moves. Britain has accused Russia of using food as a weapon of war. Yet, London itself has often resorted to blockades in an apparent attempt to push its colonial ambitions. After all, starvation has been a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
Aside from the UK using food as a weapon of war, there are other violations Britain has done. Sanctions, for example. The UK has used blockades on a host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. And when Iran was occupied by the British and Soviet forces in World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over a million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Since the financial crisis of 2008 and subsequent quantitative easing by printing billions of dollars to keep the U.S. economy afloat, the economic might and stability of the American monetary system is not what it used to be in the minds of many nations. Here we present you an article in this regard written by George Koo under the heading, Biden's Policy Toward China is a Road to Self-Destruction. The article was published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. President Joe Biden's administration appears determined to project the image that the U.S. remains the world's hegemon regardless of cost or consequences, and despite overwhelming developments around the globe that are contrary to such misguided hubris. The American leadership has always rested on the carrot and stick approach to rally countries around a unipolar world headed by the U.S. The carrot is in the form of foreign aid Uncle Sam dangles before a country as reward for joining the American camp. The stick is the threat of economic disengagement and sanctions and the withholding of military protection, thus stripping away that nation's sense of security. Since the financial crisis of 2008 and subsequent quantitative easing by printing billions of dollars to keep the U.S. economy afloat, the economic might and stability of the American monetary system is not what it used to be in the minds of many nations. When the Biden White House unilaterally confiscates foreign reserves owned by other countries but held in the U.S., such as in the cases of Afghanistan and Russia, the reputation of the U.S. as a fiduciary is in doubt. The full faith in and credit of the U.S. regime cease to mean very much to the world. Thus, the carrot has dried and withered, and after the 20-year war and debacle in Afghanistan, the stick Uncle Sam carries appears to have shriveled and is not so intimidating. Sending arms but no troops to Ukraine merely confirms America's preference for war by proxy with little appetite for direct engagement. Yet the Biden administration seems oblivious to the erosion of the U.S. stature as the world leader, but insists on going around the world, approaching each country, and demanding that it choose sides and align with the American geopolitical positions. The U.S. has elected to designate China as its adversary for the foreseeable future. For allies and would-be allies to side with the U.S. means they must also regard China as their adversary as well. The American demand places these countries in a dilemma because regarding China as an adversary is in conflict with their own national interest. China is most likely their most important trading partner and a potential major investor and major supporter in the building infrastructure under the Belt and Road Initiative. China has expressed no interest in displacing the U.S. to become the world hegemon and places no demand or expectation that countries choose sides. Friendship with China does not discourage or preclude friendship with the U.S. or any other government. Beijing's style of international diplomacy makes it easy for countries to get along with China and with the U.S. while demurring from being a fully committed formal member of the American alliance. The summit of the Americas held in Los Angeles this month, hosted by President Biden, is just the latest indication. Many Latin American countries, including Mexico, found reasons not to attend. Nothing like throwing a party that used to be a must-show event that nations now decide to bypass. The Russian State Duma Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin suggested recently that the G7 nations, once considered the world's leading economies, are continuing to crack under the weight of sanctions imposed against Russia, obviously referring to the sacrifice of their economies and economic self-interest in order to meet the demands of the U.S. Most other nations will have nothing to do with the American-imposed sanctions against Russia. From the non-compliant group of nations, Volodin proposes the formation of a new group of eight as counterweight to the G7. He selects Russia, China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, Iran, and Turkey as members of the NG8. Volodin reasons that this group of eight countries with a combined GDP measured in purchasing power parity, PPP, is 24.4% larger than that of the G7 nations. Furthermore, the NG8 contains about half of the world's population and is much more representative of world opinion and interest. Ironically, Russia left the G7 group in 2014 and is now the promoter of NG8. This development can only be attributed to American insistence on remaining on top of a unipolar world. A unipolar world vaporizing Star Trek style as we speak. The Biden White House seems to think it has succeeded in getting Ukraine to go into war with Russia and is willing to send another $40 billion worth of weapons to Kiev to enable it to fight to the last Ukrainian. They now think that they can persuade Taiwan to do the same, namely provoke China into conflict. To provoke war with China, the Taipei government would have to declare independence. Washington has been encouraging the ruling Democratic Progressive Party to inch toward that red line, selling the party leaders the idea that the U.S. is ready to go to war with Taiwan. However, a majority of people in Taiwan do not find American assurances credible, do not believe Taiwan can win a proxy war against China, and cannot justify the death and destruction it would entail just to make Washington happy. In the meantime, Beijing has invoked the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, and declared that the waters of the Taiwan Strait are within the territorial waters of China. Henceforth, any vessels belonging to foreign countries that sail between the mainland and Taiwan and challenge the sovereignty of China will be subject to attack without notice. China is a signatory of UNCLOS, while the U.S. is not. Beijing has drawn the red line based on international law. Continued provocation by American officials in Taiwan will put U.S. vessels in the Taiwan Strait in jeopardy. The Beijing expression of its intentions is as stark and unequivocal as it can be. The next move will be up to the Pentagon to see if it is willing to test China's resolve. There can be no question that China would rather fire on the U.S. Navy than threaten Taiwan with missiles. Heretofore, Biden has depended on creating more money out of thin air to keep the American economy going. Printing money has been so easy that sending $40 billion to Ukraine seems pain-free. However, conflict over Taiwan and waters around there would surely lead to a meltdown of the Fed printing stress.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab. And in this program, we discuss about the issues related to Muslim women. Well, in the previous episode, we discussed a very least spoken topic, miscarriage. And we had Sadiqa. And today also, I had this pleasure to sit with Sadiqa in the studio, who is a specialist in the field of jurisprudence. Today also, we had this pleasure to invite her. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me over.
Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for being with us again. And we were talking about Muslim women suffering through a miscarriage and how different societies behave with the women and how Islam treats miscarriage. Well, I think there's one point I wanted to tell you about miscarriages, which is pending in the last session. I could not discuss that with you. Since I come from the Indian culture, my sister suffered from the miscarriage. And when I was studying jurisprudence over here, I went through the fact that this child, the residue of this child, it needs to be shrouded and it needs to be buried. And I was very amazed to hear about this ruling. And then I just called back my sister and I told her, did you receive the residue of the child? Because I have never heard something like that happening in our culture. She said, no, I never received that. Then confirming from different societies what happens to this residue in our cultures. Unfortunately, I heard a very, very strange answer was that hospital takes this residue and puts it into the dustbin. I was really amazed over that. Since you're a jurisprudence student too, I would want to know from you, how does Islam take this residue as well? I mean, what does Islam say about that? A child who is unborn and now it's just a blood and clot and something, that it's not a full body. But still, Islam has some respect for this. I mean, that's what I got to know. I would want to know more from you.
So when we look at the concept of this child, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created humans, right? When he blew his spirit according to the Quran.
Yeah.
He says, فَتَبَارَكَ اللَّهُ أَحْسَنُ
الْخَالِقِينَ.
Praise be to the best of creators.
Best of the creators.
So the human being is created as the most perfect being. Even that child who's miscarried. And when it comes to this ruling that you mentioned, it's generally more employed after the fourth month has set in,
yes,
where the soul has entered.
Enter.
Now, this child is now seen as a human being with its own rights.
Yeah.
Right? So, given that this child has a soul, he comes under the person who is given the opportunity to become the perfect being. And therefore, if this child dies, it is given the utmost respect, just like any other person would be given. When a normal person dies, when a normal human being dies, they go through the process of shrouding and being buried. And even during the process of shrouding and washing the body, they're given utmost respect. Like, you cannot look at them, you cannot talk negative about what you saw when you were shrouding the body. And and the same concept applies to the child as well, because that child is the perfect being. It has the potential to have become the perfect being,
yeah,
had they come into this world.
Yeah.
So yes, as I said, even that child has its own rights. And we see this throughout jurisprudence, right? When you look at even the subject of inheritance,
yeah,
if a mother is pregnant with a child and the husband dies, the child who's not yet come into this world is given its inheritance when they come into this world.
Wow.
So that inheritance is supposed to be kept aside in case that child completes its pregnancy term and comes into this world.
All right.
So that child is seen as a being who has its own rights, right, its own respect, and should be treated with the normal respect.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to what to do with the residue, in very early pregnancies, because it's a clot of blood, many women would not realize that it comes
they
out from the
gone
body.
From miscarriage, yeah.
Most after the fourth month, the child has its own form.
Yeah.
So when the child is taken out from the womb, some hospitals on request would give that body for the parents to go through and bury.
Yeah.
But in some cultures, yes, they just discard it because they don't see it as a person who has its own rights.
Yeah.
And rather, in some of these cultures, they don't even respect normal human beings, let alone a miscarried child. So again, it comes down to how we treat each other as human beings.
All right, we'll continue this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
You described that so amazingly, so beautifully, like a child, and even an unborn child, has rights in Islam. Definitely human lives have human rights. And however, whenever a woman suffers through miscarriage, we discussed all that in the previous session, that how a woman is blamed that she might have gone wrong. It was the child was unborn in her womb. Rather than saying this, we as Muslims should always remember, he who relieves the hardship of a believer in this world, Allah will relieve his hardship on the day of judgment. He who makes easy what is difficult, Allah will make it easy for him in the world and the hereafter. He who conceals the faults of a Muslim, Allah will conceal his faults in the world and the hereafter. For Allah helps the servant as long as he helps his brother or sister. And that's something we have really forgotten, because we are more into blaming, more into pointing fingers towards others. Well, anyways, let's come up with another topic now. After miscarriages, now since it was something related to the pregnancy, now since a woman has a child, what does it take and what does it give?
First, let us appreciate the fact that the best and the greatest influence in every child's life is his or her mother.
Yeah.
The first influencer, right? We have the concept of influencers and on Instagram. Well, the first influencer is the mother.
Yeah.
And the role she plays in a child's life shapes who they become in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Islam appreciates this fact that the child's first university, not school, university begins in the mother's laps. They learn courage. They learn generosity. They learn kindness,
wow,
mercy. Even in Arabic, the term for womb is rahim, which means the place of mercy.
place of mercy. Wow.
So that mercy, everything that, you know, in jurisprudence, we discuss these issues as well a lot. Many years back, at least during the time of the Prophet, children would be given to wet nurses to nurse them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a whole series of conditions of a wet nurse, who she should be and what her characteristics should be so that the child would develop into a perfect human being.
Yeah.
Because even the mother's milk is important, has a role to play. So yes, the first and foremost person the child looks up to is the mother.
Okay. Well, you said, you know, when a woman is breastfeeding a child, it has a role to play. And before breastfeeding, when the pregnancy phase comes, you said everything has its own impact. Like, if you're recommended in Islam, like if you're a woman and if you're pregnant, go for ablution most of the times, like stay in ablution all the time. What kind of impact does it have?
You see, the mother, because the child is taking from her meat and her blood, from her flesh and her blood, rather,
yeah.
Because the child is constantly feeding from the mother,
yeah.
The more she stays in a state of purity, the more effect it has on the child,
yeah.
Because Islam looks at a human being as a soul and a body.
Yeah.
Again, there's a whole concept of what the body truly is, right? We are initially a soul first,
yeah,
right? So because the child is constantly feeding from the mother, mm-hmm. if the mother's state is in a state of purity, that has a great impact into what the child becomes because they're feeding off her.
Yeah, I've heard about this Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, that once it was researched about his mother and it was found that she had never fed his child without ablution, and we had seen such a great leader coming up. So it definitely has impact, and we have heard in so many recommendations like do qira'at, to recite more and more Quran when you're pregnant. And even if you're praying in congregation, if you're doing jamaat prayers, in jamaat prayers we have one of the rulings, since you're from jurisprudence field, we have one of the rulings that if the imam is reciting azan and iqamah, you don't need to recite it again. But if you are a pregnant woman, it is recommended that you recite it again. So yes, definitely it does have impact. I would like to add one of the things that, you know, when we say you need to be in ablution, you need to be reciting Quran when you're pregnant, you need to be doing a lot of recommended acts. I have read this very beautiful statement somewhere in the Islamic teachings. It was that a child who is grown up hearing Quran, his meat and blood is made while in the purity, as you mentioned, in the state of purity. He's grown up hearing Quran. Hell becomes haram for him.
When we are looking at a mother as well, we are told that even when you're going through the process of spouse selection,
yeah.
look for a woman who you would like your progeny to be in there, in yeah. her wombs. Because a woman who is courageous,
mm-hmm.
who is merciful, is going to put those same attributes into her child.
Mm-hmm.
We see that a lot in our historical narrations as well.
Yeah.
You know, when Imam Ali alayhi salam, after his wife Hazrat Fatima, wanted to get married, he told his brother Aqil, find me a wife who's courageous.
Yes.
And Aqil introduced him to another woman whose name also was Fatima, but okay. she later became known as Umm al-Banin. And she came from a very courageous tribe.
Yeah.
She herself was a very pious woman, very faithful to the Ahlul Bayt. And from her, we had four sons, the most famous of them, Abbas, who was known for his bravery and
courage.
Chivalry.
And the process goes back to selection
his
of
mother.
A partner. Yeah.
His mother was a courageous, faithful woman.
Yeah.
And that had such a great impact that today Hazrat Abbas is known as one of the most
courageous.
Important figures within the whole story of Karbala.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to the program, The Muslim Lady. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
An investigation said recently by funding and stocking products from Brazilian meat giant JBS, global financiers and UK supermarkets have supported land grabbing and deforestation. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Sophie Kevani under the heading Banks and UK Supermarkets Charged with Backing Deforestation in Brazil. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. An investigation said recently global financiers, UK supermarkets, and an Italian leather supplier have supported deforestation, land grabbing, and the use of slave labor in Brazil by funding and stocking products from the Brazilian meat giant JBS. Financial institutions mentioned in the investigation's report were HSBC, Barclays, Santander, Deutsche Bank, BlackRock, and JP Morgan. The report said the institutions had for years funneled billions of dollars to JBS and continue to do so, while at the same time pledging to remove deforestation from their portfolios. The report noted that Barclays facilitated a bond deal for JBS worth almost $1 billion last year and said the bank has continually done business with JBS over multiple years despite numerous global witness reports on the company. The report further found that between September and October of last year, investment companies controlled by Deutsche Bank, HSBC, Santander, BlackRock, and JP Morgan held shares worth more than $293 million in JBS. The supermarket selling products that used JBS beef, which were checked in February this year, were named as Sainsbury's, Iceland, and Esta. The report named the Italian leather supplier Group Masterotto as a buyer of JBS skins. Global Witness, which conducted the investigation, said its findings came as deforestation reaches record levels and while the dismantling of environmental policies and weakening of environmental agencies under Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro have been highlighted as key risks that may push the Amazon to an irreversible tipping point with devastating consequences for indigenous peoples and local communities, the global climate and biodiversity. The investigation highlighted two different types of JBS supply chain issue, direct and indirect. In the direct supply chain, the report found JBS sourcing cattle from 144 ranches in the Amazon state of Pará that contained over 10,000 football pitches of illegal Amazon clearance, contrary to its legal no deforestation obligations. The report said that in the indirect supply chain, JBS had failed to monitor a further 1,600 reaches, which it said were linked to 57,000 football pitches worth of both legal and illegal deforestation. Responding to the charges in the report, Global Witness said JBS denied the claim that all the 144 direct supply ranches were non-compliant with its no deforestation policy. In a statement to The Guardian, JBS said it had blocked one of the direct suppliers in Pará as soon as we received the NGO allegations of further fraudulent activity. The statement went on to claim JBS had a zero-tolerance policy for illegal deforestation, land grabbing, slave labor, or human rights abuses associated with our supply chains. JBS said it respected its own responsible procurement, an NGO and a state-agreed due diligence monitoring protocols at all times, and had used the best available official data to assess all potential suppliers across an area three times larger than the UK daily for the past 10 years and immediately blocked any non-compliant farms. JBS has committed to monitor its entire supply chain by 2025, including problematic indirect suppliers, but says that despite its request, the Brazilian government under Bolsonaro has not made available some of the records which are necessary. In collaboration with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and Reporter Brazil, The Guardian previously exposed links to illegal deforestation in the JBS supply chains. The company went on to reorganize and to remake a pledge to reach net zero emissions by 2040. Responding to the report's claims that it stocked JBS beef products, a Sainsbury's spokesperson said the link between cattle farming and the destruction of ecosystems like the Amazon, the Cerrado, and the Pantano is a complex issue which we take extremely seriously. It added that despite efforts to address the problems, not enough progress has been made, and as a result, we no longer offer fresh-owned brand corned beef products from Brazil. We have also committed to stop sourcing any own brand corned beef from Brazil so that we can ensure our product does not contribute to deforestation. Astaz said in an email that it does not source any of its products from the supplier named in this investigation. The link in the report between Astaz and JBS was made on the basis of Astaz stocking Exeter corned beef. Astaz claimed in an email to The Guardian that it no longer stocked Exeter products. A Santander spokesperson told The Guardian it is committed to protecting the Amazon and operates strict policies which govern our financing activity in the region. It claimed that it expected beef processing clients in the Amazon to have a fully traceable supply chain that is deforestation-free by 2025, including indirect suppliers of cattle as a prerequisite for granting credit. We believe this is the most ambitious lending standard of any bank in the region. A Deutsche Bank spokesperson claimed that it did not knowingly finance activities that result in the clearing of primary forest, involve illegal logging or conversion of high conservation value, high carbon stocks, forest, or peatlands. Where we work with conglomerates, we make a significant effort to ensure our financing is only directed to activities that are in line with our policies. HSBC referred The Guardian to its response in the report, which said its asset management business held shares in the beef giant on behalf of others and that it had no influence over the decision to invest in JBS. BlackRock similarly pointed The Guardian to its responses in the report, which claimed it had engaged with the company to seek improved compliance with its commitments, and that its voting record at JBS annual shareholders meeting showed it objected to the company's poor oversight of risk management processes, including on its sustainability performance. JP Morgan told The Guardian that it declined to comment on the charges. Barclays declined to comment to The Guardian, but told Global Witness that it was committed to purportedly helping its corporate clients achieve zero net deforestation. Group MassRoto told Global Witness that while it admitted purchasing from JBS Tannery in Para, the purchase volumes were small and that it had since stopped buying from JBS. Iceland, meanwhile, claimed that it engaged with its suppliers to ensure they sourced their beef responsibly.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.